Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Ben Tosig, editor of the American Values Club Crossword, which he previously edited for The Onion's AV Club. He's just published a provocative look at the game's first 100 years, The Curious History of the Crossword. Stick around. You just know he's a pen guy, don't you? So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that includes people who can read words backwards and forwards, tell you the meaning of anything, and correctly spell onomatopoeia, but can't balance a checkbook, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. My wife is the games player in our house, and my life and ego were a lot less stressed when I accepted that she could beat me at pretty much anything that challenged the brain, from crosswords to Sudoku, checkers to chess, even backgammon to Monopoly. That's why I rarely attempt to solve puzzles any longer in her presence. She gets very competitive and impatient if I can't do one as quickly as she can. Well, it doesn't bother me anymore. I'm actually proud of her. And my daughter's mind seems to work much the same way. When she applies herself, I see glimpses of a mind that will one day be faster and sharper than either of ours. Probably sooner than I think. The world, it seems, is one of the constructors and solvers. And I am on the outside looking in. But whether you like crossword puzzles or not, it's hard not to be fascinated by their construction and grace. And, for the writer in me, the crisp, efficient language engaged to prompt and tickle the reader. That's what drew me to Ben Tosig and his new book, The Curious History of the Crossword. The bedrock of almost every major and minor English language newspaper around the world, the Crossword celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2013, and Tosig's Curious History is packed with short, precise clues and even a number of full sentences. It also reproduces more than 100 classic crossword puzzles. Ben Tosig, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you.
So, pen or pencil?
I solve with pen every time that I solve on paper. I'm about 50-50 between solving digitally and solving on paper. But when I do solve on paper, always pen.
Another show off. Just what I needed. Thanks.
There's nothing wrong with solving in pencil. I just don't keep a lot of pencils in my house. So if that was what I had, I wouldn't feel superior for using it.
All right. So let me ask you this. What, if anything, can a man of your great experience deduce from watching someone else try to solve the New York Times crossword puzzle?
From watching someone else try to solve the puzzle? Well, as an editor, I guess I watch people solve crosswords, and I think about the order in which they're doing it, and the easy parts, and the places where they're having trouble, and I pay a lot of attention to that, because when you design a puzzle, you try to design it in such a way that you bring them through the experience, you know, in certain kinds of pre-realized ways. So you know that they're going to have trouble with one area and probably finish that one last. So I'm usually watching for that when I watch people solve.
Can you tell from watching someone try to do the New York Times puzzle if they're a dumbass or not?
No, I can't. I can't. Because crossword intelligence is its own type of intelligence. So I can tell you from experience, from lots of experience, that it's wrong to judge anyone's general intelligence on their crossword intelligence. It's practice like anything else.
On the other hand, if you saw someone struggle with the USA Today puzzle, would you make a snap judgment?
I would probably make a snap judgment in that case.
I think in the book you quote John Stewart about the USA Today puzzle, and I guess that's my naivete. I didn't realize how different the puzzles really were, but apparently they are extremely different.
They're quite different, and I'm not going to talk too much smack. The New York Times puzzle, along with many others, has a standard of editing that doesn't allow for mistakes or irregularities, or really even just lousy fill, for the most part. I mean, there are exceptions to that, but you know, when you get down to the People magazine puzzles and stuff like that, you know, you'll see terrible errors and redundancies and things that just aren't fun to encounter if you're a solver.
Now, you use a word that most people know, but maybe not in this context. You referred to fill. Now, fill. Is that fill as in, okay, you have the major clues and answers,
yeah,
and fill is what goes in between to connect the words?
Yeah, that's right. What you described as the major answers are called the theme answers. So the themed puzzles usually have those 3 to 4 long answers, often going across 15 letters or 13 letters, and they all tie into each other. And then the fill is everything else. So those are the words that are non-thematic, but that you have to fill out to finish the puzzle anyways.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so there's smart fill and there's stupid fill, basically?
Yeah. Well, I would say there's solver-friendly fill and there's kind of cruel and lazy fill. And solver-friendly fill is anything ranging from words that we encounter every day, common vocabulary, actors, musicians who we all know. That stuff is friendly fill because while you can clue it to a range of difficulties, it's stuff everybody knows. Cruel and lazy fill is, abbreviations, rare abbreviations for organizations that barely anyone knows. Grocery store chains that only exist in 5 states. Things that you encounter and you're just like, what is that? You know, even after you fill it out, if you fill it out, you look at it and you say, like, I'm totally unsatisfied because I don't know what that is. Mm.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned that, the grocery store chains that are, you know, in 5 states.
Yeah.
Would a convenience store chain like Wawa, would that qualify as smart fill or stupid fill?
I wouldn't call it stupid fill, but I would call it bad fill. I've got it in my list somewhere because you can clue it as a Wawa pedal or at worst as a sound. But yeah, you know, and I actually lived in Philly for a while, so I mean, I'm very familiar with Wawa, but my experience isn't everybody's experience, you know. So I don't expect a Canadian to know about a convenience store in Philly. So.
No, but see, now that's interesting. You said Canadian because Wawa is a Canadian goose.
Oh, okay.
So
so maybe if you had the opportunity to clue it differently for the Canadian paper, then you could do that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, from what I've read and now seeing you, I mean, you're a very young man. You've been active in puzzles, I guess, on the professional side for about a decade.
Yeah.
How did you become so interested in that you would research the history and derivation of the crosswords as much as you did for this book? It seems like that's something that a guy or a man or a woman would, you know, maybe in their 50s or 60s or older would do, but... What was the appeal?
Yeah, well, the book project was proposed by the publisher, and they were looking for somebody to do it, and they were kind of they were fairly open-ended about how it might have come together. And when they talked to me about it, I gave them my proposal, and really, I think it was motivated just by the desire to talk about a number of issues that had interested me for a long time, being involved with crosswords. And I actually didn't want to do it chronologically. Because it's the 100th anniversary of the crossword, I think there was a temptation to do a kind of narrative history of the crossword puzzle. Like, this is what's happening in the 20s. This is what was happening in the 30s. But I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to do more of an issue-based book, which is why, you know, I have a chapter about technology, which is, I think, just an interesting subject, gender and crosswords. They're subjects that interest me in the present. So I wrote about them in the present, but I also did a little bit of research to find out, you know, kind of how those same issues had played out in the past. So it was really, I mean, it was kind of just, you know, you do something for a while and, you know, you start to develop opinions about it. And I just wanted to put my opinions down. So because it was a historic moment, the centennial. I did it, you know, with an eye towards history, but really the main motivation was just writing out my opinion.
And the book seems to be more thematic than anything. I mean, there's right. chapters on humor, there's chapters right. on gender yeah. in terms of the constructors, right? Yeah, it's interesting. It just seems like something someone would come to much later in their career, but I guess, yeah. you know, the 100th anniversary is only going to happen once, and so if you're handed the right. opportunity, there you go.
Right. I'm an opinionated person, and so I think it came naturally to me to do it that way.
Now, the book is full of sidebars, as mm-hmm. we call them in newspapers. I don't know if right. the average person knows. But they're the little boxes that are set off from the rest of the text. Right. They're curious things that you've discovered.
Sure.
In researching the book, mm-hmm. what were some of the more curious things that surprised you that you didn't already know?
Well, I think that the sensibilities of the early crossword puzzles were maybe what fascinated me the most. They were very New York-centric, the early puzzles. The first puzzle, of course, appeared in the New York World, but most of the newspapers that picked up the crossword within that first decade were in New York City or other urban areas on the East Coast. And so it was kind of fascinating to see that. They also could be a little bit racier than I would have imagined. You know, I kind of, because the New York Times cleaned them up as soon as they adopted the crossword in 42, I guess I had assumed that early crossword puzzles were incredibly kind of scrubbed clean of any references that might make anybody feel uncomfortable. But the old crosswords from the teens and 20s had words, you know, about nudity, about alcohol, about, you know, bodily functions. You know, a lot of them were straight definitions, but, you know, they were using words of all kinds, like vocabulary of all kinds. They were definitely kind of adult-oriented in that way. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
And you talk, I think this is an entire chapter about yeah. the kind of the breakfast test.
Do you want
to explain? That was interesting because having kind of come up through newspapers,
right.
I knew exactly what you were talking about. Right. But can you explain that a little bit for the average person?
Yeah, the breakfast test or the breakfast table test is a term in journalism that generally refers to the idea that you shouldn't print anything that people wouldn't want to read about while they were eating breakfast. So, you know, you're sitting there at your breakfast table, you're, you know, having a cup of tea and some porridge, and, you know, maybe you're a person of sensitive sensibilities in the first place, and, you know, you see a graphic image of something violent or, you know, something disturbing, and, you know, and you stop wanting to engage with it, right? So newspaper people try to draw a line at what might repulse a reader. And that got brought into the crossword puzzle only with the New York Times. That didn't apply to the crossword before the New York Times. But early New York Times editors would reject answers that had to do with, for example, disease, because they felt that it would upset people who were trying to solve the puzzle while they were eating breakfast. So that was the breakfast table test. And it still exists to a certain extent.
Not as much of a concern, I guess, if you're constructing crosswords for online or
right.
Like a magazine you would pick up at the newsstand, because
yeah.
people are doing all kinds of things. But even blood test was considered not acceptable.
Right? Right. Yeah, blood test was seen as something that might upset people, which today, I mean, that's, you know, Will Shortz would run blood tests, but 50 years ago, 60 years ago, I guess that was seen as just a little bit too much. But with the independent puzzles, such as the American Values Club and a number of other puzzles, it's almost part of the point to find ways to violate the breakfast table test. Hmm. Because there isn't the same concern with circulation and, you know, a family readership and propriety. So making dirty jokes is kind of an art in the modern crossword.
Now, a minute ago, you mentioned Will Shortz, who's mm-hmm. pretty much the household name in your mm-hmm. business for the average person.
Right.
He's the New York Times crossword editor,
yeah.
last I recall.
Right.
I was wondering, are there other people in the business who should be household names, or who, I guess there's probably three levels, right? There's
yeah.
there's probably like Will Shortz at the top.
Mm-hmm.
People who do crosswords all seem to know him. And
yeah.
then there's probably... So that's even the general consumer would know Will.
Right.
And then after him, there's probably a group of people that the real heavy-duty solvers probably know.
Yeah.
And then there's the rest of people who probably no one really knows.
Right. Well, I'd say actually there might even be another level beyond that. Okay. Because there are sort of semi-celebrities. I mean, Will Shortz is for sure the first New York Times crossword editor who has crossed over into kind of mainstream celebrity. And that's because partly of his NPR show, you know, he's the puzzle master on Weekend Edition. Mm-hmm. So he has a mass audience, and he's an appealing guy. He speaks well. He can explain what he does very, very clearly, and he likes funny puns. So, you know, it has a mass appeal. But there are a number of other people who kind of have achieved a medium celebrity. Like, Shortz was on The Simpsons a few years ago, and he went on with Merle Regal, who actually lives in St. Petersburg, where you are.
Yeah.
Or near there, Tampa Bay, maybe, Tampa. But he, I think, has a kind of a minor celebrity. He might not be a household name around the country to everyone, but, you know, certainly he has tens of thousands of fans. Mm-hmm. And then people like Brendan Emmett Quigley, who runs an extremely popular blog, has a certain kind of celebrity. Liz Gorski, who's published in the Times for a very long time. I mean, these people have name recognition that's quite wide. So, yeah, I mean, I do think those people should sort of have more of a platform, because Shortz as editor certainly plays a very important role, but you'll notice that when you're a crossword person and you talk to people about puzzles and they don't know puzzles that well, they'll say like, oh, I didn't realize that Will Shortz didn't just write all the puzzles. Hmm. And you kind of like smack your head and say, no, but there are constructors who are very good at this, and one wishes that they had a little bit more recognition. Well, the editor is important, but the constructors are really the artists.
Well, let's talk about the constructors for a minute. So, two major questions, I guess. One is, how many puzzles can a constructor do in a week, and can you make a living creating puzzles?
Yeah, the first question. Well, both questions, I guess, are complicated. I write anywhere between one and four puzzles a week, wow, depending on how busy I am. It's certainly possible to write even more than that if you're going at it full time. Making a living as a constructor is very hard because the major venues all accept work as freelance work only. So you're getting $200 for a puzzle that might take you, a day to write. Mm. And the ideas are fairly scarce. So, it's difficult to make a living at that unless you're in a very particular kind of situation. But increasingly there have been opportunities to earn money as a constructor or editor working outside of the established systems. So we at the American Values Club became a buy subscription service after we left The Onion. And now people go to the website and they buy an annual subscription, which is avxwords.com. And we re-support ourselves. We pay the constructors out of the subscription money, and I pay myself as an editor out of the subscription money. So, we've created a new institution now that pays artists and actually pays them more equitably than the mainstream papers pay. So there are, with new technologies, there have come new opportunities for people to get paid for their work and to potentially make a living.
All right. Well, let me ask you a kind of a follow-up to that. It's a nitty-gritty question. How does one start a crossword puzzle? How do I sit down? Do I just, take pen and paper and draw a grid of, or do I just start with do I do the words and then the grid forms around it? How does one do that?
Well, the first thing that happens is usually away from the grid itself, and it's a spark. So that would be an idea that comes to you, at any point during the day. You could be having a conversation with somebody, you could be in the shower, you could be working on another project and just sort of see some relationship between words that's exciting or interesting that you think could sustain a theme. And so that spark then becomes this idea for a puzzle. And then you sit down and you figure out what kinds of theme answers would work for your concept. Mm-hmm. And you plot those out, and you try to find them in symmetrical lengths. And once you have a theme set, then you can actually start building the puzzle. So you put in your, you know, let's say four entries of equal length. Let's say they're all 13 letters. You put them in the grid. And at this point, the grid has no black squares. So you just put them in a symmetrical order. And then you build the black squares around them in a way that you think can be filled with the shorter fill. And then you fill in that shorter fill, and finally you write the clues. So that's the process.
So you have the words, mm-hmm. the answers first, and then you go back and do the clues.
Right. The clues are always last.
I would have never guessed that.
Yeah.
And so the variables then, it seems like, are size of the words, for example, mm-hmm. size of the total puzzle, the theme, some puzzles have themes, some don't.
Right.
And then the shape of the puzzle. The standard, I guess, is the square, but
yeah.
it's not always a square.
Right. Usually it is. I mean, there are rare exceptions, but the puzzle has been standardized in its shape, its size and shape and constraints since basically the New York Times adopted a crossword puzzle in 1942. Hmm. If there is a reason to use a differently shaped puzzle, you can do it, but typically you have to have a rationale of some kind. Either you're there's some visual element that requires the puzzle to be, you know, to have rounded edges or something along those lines. But, you know, without a rationale, you wouldn't really ever do it. Hmm.
Tell me about the tools of the trade. You talk a bit about this in the book, about whether it's acceptable nowadays to use a search engine or Google or online. What's acceptable in your mind as a tool of the trade, and what is not?
Well, almost all of us who construct use construction software. So, you know, it would be a little silly to say that that was cheating. You still have to do all the work yourself. The software mostly cuts out the parts that are just frustrating and time-consuming. So that, I think, it's absolutely within bounds. And we all use Google. We all use the same kinds of references that everyone uses to find information. Mm-hmm. It presents, you know, opportunities as well as challenges. I mean, you know, we all know what it means to sort of be lazy in the era of internet research. And when I'm editing a puzzle, sometimes I'll see a certain kind of pattern emerging and somebody's cluing. So I have no problem with people using Wikipedia as a reference. Of course, Wikipedia, always being an encyclopedia, cites other sources. So you should make sure that the source being cited is reputable. But the problem that I find with using too much Wikipedia is a certain kind of trivial tone, mm-hmm. Where clues read like sentences from Wikipedia. So in the past, a lot of clues were straight definitions, and now, particularly now, they've evolved into these kind of factoids. So clues, especially for things like Oreo, that we're all tired of writing the same clues for, people will go to the Wikipedia page and say, like, oh, Oreo had a, you know, a special 100th anniversary cookie design that was green or whatever. And then they'll put that fact in as the clue for Oreo. And it kind of reads like a trivia contest. And so I think that creates a certain kind of problem that I like to edit out of puzzles. I wouldn't consider it cheating. I just consider it a sort of an issue in modern construction.
Okay.
As for solvers, I think you make up your own boundaries. If you feel like you want to be able to solve without citing any references, then that's your rule. If you feel like you want to give yourself a limit of five lookups per puzzle, then that's your rule. If you want to be able to consult a friend but not use a book or the internet, then that's your rule. You know, the puzzle exists for the solver's pleasure, so they get to make up what's right and wrong.
It's whatever you can live with.
Yes.
Okay.
Whatever your conscience tells you is acceptable.
One of the things there was a real good anecdotal piece in the book about how you came up in the business, and there was a woman who helped you. I don't want to get into the history of that, because I think people should read it. It's kind of entertaining. It sounds like a real character, frankly. But the other thing you talk about in terms of men and women is it seemed like in the earlier years of the crossword, women were more common as constructors, and now they seem to be in the minority. And I wondered if you had a sense of why that flip-flopped, if it did.
Yeah, I don't have an easy answer for it. There are certainly still many women involved in crosswords. There are fewer editors today, and the number of constructors working for the Times has gone down. I don't know, and I'm not sure that I could give a firm answer for why that's happened in the past couple of decades. But, you know, I think it's reversible, and the obligation that I see for editors, whether they're at big newspapers or blogs, is just that, you know, they need to be kind of welcoming and, you know, not allow these sort of boys club environments to perpetuate, because really crossword puzzles are something that should be open to everybody and that should feel like a fun game no matter who you are. And, you know, it's good for business. It's good for the vibe. It's good for everything.
Can you tell in working a puzzle that it was created by a woman versus a man, or are the references different? Or
some people say that they are. I think you can tell somebody's personality. So maybe in some cases you could tell if it was a man or a woman. But you know, when you solve enough puzzles, you start to know, like, oh wow, this is Brendan M. McQuigley's voice. This is Patrick Blindauer's voice. This is Patrick Barry's voice. This is Liz Gorski's voice. This is Nancy Solomon's voice. People really put their stamp on their puzzles. They prefer certain ways of cluing. They come up with particular kinds of themes that can be very, very idiosyncratic. So yeah, I mean, you do get a personality there.
And what about the issue of speed? Do you have any sense of whether men or women can solve a puzzle quicker?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the champions over the past decade or so have, I think, exclusively been men, but that's really only two people, Dan Fayer and Tyler Hinden, who have dominated recently. And there's lots and lots of women who solve in the top five, the top ten. People like Amy Rinaldo and Ann Erdman and Stella Sawastowski, all of them are highly accomplished speed solvers. So I don't think there's a vast difference between men and women in terms of speed.
I ask that because in the earlier section of the book, I think one of the newspapers used to put the time above
right.
the puzzle that I think Ruth, I can't think of her last name.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The time it took her to solve this puzzle so you could test yourself against her.
Yeah.
Is it important to be fast, or is it more important to be accurate, or does it not
yeah.
even matter?
No, it's entirely up to you and what makes you happy. Ruth Von Pool was the original speed solver, and I think she's a great character because she was the first dynamo of crossword puzzles and the first crossword celebrity of any kind. You know, she's 21 and she was setting the speed record for every puzzle that was running in the newspapers. And so, you know, they would print what was called the bogey time. So the bogey time was set by Ruth Von Pool. So this is what you can aspire to as a solver, you know, see how close you can get to this champion. And some people like to solve that way. I would say that probably most people prefer to savor a puzzle and to do it a little bit slowly and maybe come back to it a couple times. But it just depends on you. Different strokes.
A couple years ago, I remember when Sudoku was very hot in the United States and it seemed like
yeah.
it was kind of overtaking crosswords. Has it kind of backed off?
It seems to have cooled down a little bit as a trend. It's a very different kind of puzzle. I don't think it ever challenged crosswords in terms of popularity because it has no semantic dimension. Mm. It's only a logic puzzle. It's about putting the right things in the right places. But what makes crosswords so much fun is that it's about language and it's about the funny, creative things that human beings do with language. That's also part of the reason why it's so enduring, is because people do fascinating new things with language all the time. And you know, every time some new linguistic twerk comes around, quirk, I should say. That's a
linguistic twerk?
A Freudian slip. This one right there. Twerk being, you know, just an interesting word that emerged in 2013. But we do interesting, quirky things with language. And, you know, we didn't have, for example, hate watching 3 years ago or 4 years ago. We didn't have hate reading. But now you kind of have that word hate affixed to the beginning of these terms of consumption. And, you know, that's a puzzle right there. That was a puzzle that I did, was one that had answers like Hate Reader's Digest. Mm. That's a joke that wouldn't have made sense, you know, before people started using the term hate read. But now it's, you know, it's really funny. A Hate Reader's Digest. It's like a compendium of articles that, you know, that you actually don't like to read. So that's, you know, that's part of what makes puzzles continually fun to make.
And yeah, you talk about how language changes over the years too. And I mean, I think about this going back to my my high school newspaper days. We had terrible trouble in eighth or ninth grade putting the word. We had the newspaper, and there was a review. This is a long time ago, folks. I'm sorry, I'm old. It was a review of the movie American Graffiti when it came out. And the student who wrote the review said it was a bitchin' movie.
Uh-huh.
And that slipped into the school paper. Mm-hmm. And she may have gotten suspended over it. The newspaper was seized. And mm-hmm. I think, wow, just a few years later, who would have blinked over that? You make the example of using the acronym LGBT.
Yeah.
You want to tell that story quickly? What happened
sure.
there?
Sure, yeah. So when I started out in crossword puzzles, I was kind of, I still didn't really have a grasp on what you could put in a puzzle and what you couldn't. And one word came along, or one acronym or initialism, that was very helpful for me in a puzzle I was making. And that was LGBT, which stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And it's a kind of a general term. It's an adjective for organizations that do gay rights work. To me, it was very common. You know, I just finished college, and LGBT is all over a college campus, you know, almost anywhere you go. So I wrote to the crossword constructors email list, and I said, hey, what do people think about LGBT as an entry? I've never seen it in any crossword puzzle. And sure enough, I checked the database, and it had never been in a mainstream crossword puzzle. And I got back something like 9 answers, all of which were no. You can't use this answer. It's unfamiliar. It's too controversial for a mainstream paper. Just don't use it. And I remember being kind of bothered by that. But, you know, I guess I, you know, took it for what it was. And then something like 9 years later, someone else independently wrote to the same email list and asked about LGBT. They said the same thing that I'd said. It's never appeared in a mainstream paper, but why not? You know, can I put it in my puzzle? And this time around, after, you know, 8 or 9 years having passed, DOMA being overturned, most of the people who responded to this person said that LGBT was an acceptable entry. So you see, like, the evolution of acceptability that runs through both politics and language.
Hmm. And have you seen the word twerk in a puzzle yet?
Of course.
So things are acceptability of language changes seem to be happening faster now than they did.
I think so. Well, and part of what's happened is that because people can publish puzzles faster, mm-hmm. and here I'm talking about the blog puzzles. Mm-hmm. So Brendan, who I mentioned before, Brendan Emma Quigley, is famous for getting new words into his puzzles right away. So, you know, probably within a week, if not less, after the VMAs where Miley Cyrus popularized that word, you know, he had twerk in a puzzle. And at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if it was queued up for a New York Times puzzle. But the New York Times has a much slower publication cycle than the blogs and the independent puzzles. So, you know, you're talking about anywhere from 6 months to 5 years before your puzzle sees the light of day if you send it to the New York Times. Whereas with the independents, you know, it could come out within hours of you writing it.
Wow. Well, before we wind up, just a couple more questions, specifically about newspapers. Crosswords have been one of the most reliable parts of the newspaper, pretty much all. I mentioned English language newspaper only because I don't know if they're as popular in other languages. But newspapers have been shrinking in recent years. International news has been going away in papers. General features, they're picking up syndicated concert and movie reviews. What do you think will outlast? What do you think will last longer in the newspapers? Will it be the crossword or the sports section? Which will be off, you know, hands off the longest?
No, I mean it's a key question for all of us these days. And the crossword puzzle still makes a lot of money for the New York Times, but that doesn't mean that it's going to continue existing in the form that we're familiar with it. They have an increasing number of online subscribers. That's more and more important to their business, and it's quite profitable. So they'll keep doing that for a long time, but we may not see it being distributed on paper for forever. But this is really the kind of gap that we've stepped into that the American Values Club exists to address. And when we left The Onion, and the reason that the Onion dropped us was because they were essentially moving away from print entirely. And at this point, I think they've discontinued all of their print editions. We didn't know what was going to happen. When we decided to become independent, we had no clue if people were going to support us. Paying for a crossword puzzle was a totally alien idea, and I had a fear that everyone would reject it and that we wouldn't make enough to sustain ourselves. But we did a Kickstarter. That was the first step, and that was also a way of gauging how many people would be willing to stick with us and pay $15 a year. And we got $27,000. So, you know, when that happened, we were like, oh, okay, this is actually something that people would be willing to support. So, and we've, you know, we've been doing it for a year now, and we've been very successful. So I guess that the era of, you know, independent by subscription, I guess to use an apt term, on-demand crosswords is upon us. So, you know, we're kind of becoming delinked from the newspaper. I think that's the process that we're seeing happening now.
Well, so you've got the new book, which remind folks is The Curious History of the Puzzle. That's out now. You've worked on other puzzle-related books. You've got the what I guess is your day job, the AVX.
The American Values Club, as puzzles go, that's my day job, yes.
And is there anything else coming up next? Do you have another project planned?
Crossword-wise, we just have a really great year of American Values Club puzzles, bonus puzzles, specialty puzzles, celebrity collaborations, a full slate of that stuff this year. No books coming up immediately, but that might change.
All right. Cool. Well, folks, listen, you can find Ben Tausig's fascinating celebration of puzzles, puzzle culture, and the people who create them, constructors, and a little bit about solvers, The Curious History of the Puzzle. It's in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching us on the Mr. Media site, I know there's a lot of places you can watch Mr. Media, but if you're watching on the Mr. Media site, somewhere down over there is probably a cover of the book. You can click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon, buy it instantly, buy some other stuff, and you can have it, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours, very quickly. Do you want to give out your website again, Ben?
Sure. Yeah, it's avxwords.com.
avxwords.com. Chances are, folks, it's right here along the screen, so just follow that. Are you on Twitter, Facebook? Do you do any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, Twitter, I'm at Data General, D-A-T-A General.
Okay. Ben, it's a really interesting book. Not something I knew a lot about. I've always been curious about it, even though it's, you know, as I explained at the beginning, my wife could pretty much whip my ass at crossword puzzles and any other kind of puzzle. But yeah. Fascinating reading. Good talking to you. And thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.